Random House Audio presents Hoodwinked. An economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. By John Perkins. Read for you by David Aykroyd. Introduction. I was an economic hitman, EHM. Part of an elite corps of modern-day hired guns who promote the interests of big corporations and certain sectors of the U.S. government. I had a fancy title, Chief Economist, and a staff of highly qualified economists, management consultants, and financial analysts who produced impressive reports that appeared legitimate. But my real job was to deceive and plunder the Third World. Although we EHMs work in many ways, our most common task is to identify countries with resources our corporations covet. Then we seduce, bribe, and extort their leaders into exploiting their own people, accepting loans the countries can never repay, privatizing their national assets, legalizing the destruction of fragile environments, and finally, selling those coveted resources to our corporations at bargain prices. When the leaders resist, they are overthrown or assassinated by CIA-sponsored jackals. We were so successful in the Third World that our bosses directed us to implement similar strategies in the United States and across the rest of the planet. The result is an unsustainable form of capitalism that is the driving force behind the current economic crisis. Despite temporary recoveries, this crisis is the leading edge of a global tsunami. I jotted down those words while my Iceland Air 757 landed very early in the morning at Reykjavik on March 5, 2009, after an exhausting all-night flight from Florida. Staring out into the blackness, I suddenly had the sensation that I was back in the late 1800s, arriving by stagecoach in an old West boomtown, perhaps Tombstone, Arizona, or Deadwood, South Dakota, and that the boomtown's collapse was just another symptom that the tsunami was building energy. Considered a poor, underdeveloped, and distant cousin to Europe until recently, Iceland's economy had suddenly exploded, rising to the rank of the planet's third wealthiest nation per capita on the World Bank's 2007 list. Reykjavik had mushroomed into a boomtown where people amassed fortunes overnight. Celebrities, gamblers, con artists, and economic hitmen arrived in droves. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and most of the other big Wall Street firms dispatched their necktied armies. Applying a model similar to that used to exploit Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia, and all the countries whose oil or other precious natural resources propelled them into instant materialism, men and women with my old job convinced individuals and the government to mortgage to the hilt. People embarked on a made-for-Hollywood buying spree. They purchased Miami mansions, Beverly Hills condos, British department stores, Danish airlines, Bentleys and Rolls-Royces, Norwegian power plants, and even an English soccer team. In 2007, the country's citizens possessed approximately 50 times more foreign assets than they had in 2002. Iceland's stock market skyrocketed by a multiple of 9 from 2003 to 2007, while the U.S. market merely doubled. Reykjavik's real estate prices tripled. The average family's wealth grew by 3 times over a period of 3 years. The raw material for Iceland's boom, its gold, was hydroelectric and geothermal power. The glaciers, rivers, volcanoes, and underground hot springs appeared to offer limitless amounts of energy. Because this resource cannot be boxed or barreled, it had to be exploited on site. The biggest of the big energy users, the aluminum companies, came to Iceland in the late 1960s. During the next 4 decades, as global aluminum demand soared, they convinced Iceland's leaders to construct power plants for the sole purpose of energizing foreign-owned smelters. Alcoa made an offer that would place Iceland on the map, a deal to build a mammoth water-to-aluminum complex in the remote north. All Iceland had to do was commit to a very large loan. Collateralized by the revenues anticipated from the sale of kilowatt hours, and hire foreign corporations to build a dam and power plant to generate over 600 megawatts to fire just this one smelter, compared to the 300 megawatts used by all the people of Iceland. Of course, it was not quite that simple. Scientists discovered that the dam site straddled an earthquake fault line, and that the area to be flooded, about the size of Manhattan, in a country slightly smaller than Kentucky, contained rare ecosystems. The people looked the other way while their government waived environmental laws and issued special condition construction permits. In June 2007, Alcoa inaugurated its aluminum factory, built by the United States Bechtel Corporation. The new factory was slated to produce 346,000 metric tons of aluminum per year, which was 10 times the capacity of the country's first plant. The people celebrated. That is, until they learned that their utility company was hemorrhaging tens of thousands of dollars every hour that Alcoa ran its equipment. On October 6, 2008, the unheard of happened. Iceland's banks, which had grown to many times the size of the country's national economy, collapsed. Losses totaled $100 billion and were rising. The country's debt had swollen to 850% of its gross domestic product, GDP. Iceland went belly up. As my plane taxied along the runway, I wondered whether Reykjavik would look like Tombstone and Deadwood after the gold panned out, and whether within the hour I would be walking the streets of a ghost town, vacant except for thieves, panhandlers, washed-up gunfighters, and perhaps an EHM-turned drunkard or two. I had no doubt that Iceland was a harbinger. One of the reasons I had taken this trip was because I wanted to understand the details surrounding the first hit of a developed country. If the rest of us did not learn from this nation's tragedy, we were likely to suffer similar consequences. Iceland, along with the United States and much of the world, had suffered from a specific type of capitalism, a deviant that my business school professors had foreseen and railed against in the late 1960s. The proponents had instilled in business and government leaders from Wall Street to Shanghai a set of values that was leading us all to meltdowns like those experienced by the Third World since the beginning of the 1970s, the time when I joined the EHM ranks, and now by Iceland. The guiding philosophy for this particular form of capitalism is an uncompromising belief in the privatization of resources, the granting of unfettered powers to corporate executives, and the encouragement of debt so extreme that it results in contemporary modes of enslavement for countries and individuals alike. Based on the assumption that the CEOs running our most powerful corporations constitute a special class of royalty who, unlike normal people, do not need to be governed by regulations, it totally altered geopolitics. Now we have entered a time not unlike that when city-states were replaced by nations, except that today the nations have been usurped by the giant corporations. The problem, as my business professors understood, was not capitalism. The problem was the abuse of capitalism and the fact that so many people were infected by the mutant virus. The plane jerked to a stop, and I wondered about our chances for controlling the virus before it multiplied into an epidemic. I walked off the plane, made my way through customs, and then was met by a young man who introduced himself as my chauffeur and was built like a wrestler. He led me outside. The dim light of a breaking morning was diffused by a cold drizzle that felt like it could turn to snow at any moment. As I hoisted myself up into his SUV, I had the sensation that I was clambering aboard a stagecoach headed for Deadwood. "I wish I had bought a smaller car," he said apologetically, apparently interpreting my momentary confusion as an expression of condemnation. "But that was almost a year ago. Who could have guessed?" Not long after leaving the airport, He pointed through the dark mists at a compound of buildings and explained that it had been a U.S. military base with more than 1,200 military personnel until the Pentagon pulled out in 2006. I asked if it was a ghost town now. Hardly, he replied. One of our universities took it over. Students replaced the soldiers. He made a clucking sound with his tongue. Your government sank a fortune into those facilities before departing. Why? He peered at me, the sort of look a professor gives a student who ought to know better. I heard the contractors made out like bandits. Rain spattered against the windshield, and I stared through it onto a barren landscape. Craggy stones were scattered across the rocky surface, as though an angry god had shaken his fist and dropped them randomly. Volcanic lava flow, my driver said. Then, pointing at a snowfield that disappeared into a cloud, he added, "Over there is the mountain that caused all this." I mentioned reading that NASA had trained Apollo astronauts here before sending them to the moon. "Yeah, that's true," he agreed. "But eventually the trolls drove them out." Trolls? Nordic mythological creatures, a sort of combination of elves and giants. Tough little critters. He paused and then gave me a Cheshire cat grin. Alcoa hired an exorcist to certify that no trolls would be displaced before building their new smelter. Rumor has it the expert was a charlatan, and Iceland's economic problems are the trolls' retaliation. He nodded toward the side window. See those? Through the glass, I spotted several tall cairns constructed from volcanic rocks. The funny statues? Yeah. Sunshine turns trolls to stone. Sometimes they get caught out in the open when the sun breaks through. He chuckled. Doesn't happen often. You don't get that much sun here. Troll economics, I said without thinking. He gave me a quizzical look. Just a thought. I shrugged my shoulders. What can I say? I'm an economist. Oh. Although I could not interpret his expression, I figured he was wondering what more an economist thought he could take from his country. Those two words, troll economics, stuck with me. I kept hearing them as we drove on toward Reykjavik. If trolls had been involved in this classic hit, they had assumed human form and wormed themselves into jobs with Alcoa, the government, and the banks. An image of a bald-headed man with an impish smile and dragonfly glasses popped into my mind. It was a photo I had recently seen of a trollish Milton Friedman, the Nobel laureate from the Chicago School of Economics. He, more than any other individual, had convinced Iceland, and most every other country, to shun policies that had rescued us from the Great Depression. He had worked his magic to promote that predatory form of capitalism that had brought Iceland down. "There it is," my driver exclaimed, pointing at buildings just visible through the rain. "The root of all our problems, the first of our aluminum plants, now owned by Rio Tinto Alcan." I squinted through the windshield wipers. A couple of huge cylindrical towers loomed out of the fog. Stationed above a pier that stretched over the ocean, they reminded me of castle turrets from an old movie about medieval battles. Juxtaposed next to them was a lower building that seemed to stretch forever across the land. "That one," my driver said, indicating the building that could have housed the world's longest freight train, "is a mile in length. There are three of them. The other two are hidden behind the one you see." Neither of us spoke as we approached and then drove past the aluminum plant. Not a person was in sight. Nothing moved. The place might have been abandoned, except my driver assured me that it was not. "Operates night and day," he said matter-of-factly. Like other industrial sites I had visited, coal mines, pulp and paper plants, oil refineries, and nuclear power stations, I found the sheer magnitude overwhelming. It was impossible to place it in any sort of context, yet I knew that this plant's production capacity, despite increases since its construction, was far less than that of the new Alcoa smelter. I turned in my seat to watch it disappear into the rain behind us. "There's your ghost town," the driver said, interrupting my concentration. Off to our right were row upon row of quaint suburban-style houses, all vacant. He shook his head sadly and made that odd clucking sound again. Great deals, they say, if you're looking for a home in Iceland. I studied them as we drove on. They did not meet my expectations. No dust-blown streets, tumbleweeds, shuttered dance halls, or doors slamming in the wind. About 45 minutes after leaving the airport, we arrived in Reykjavik. "I'm going to take you on a bit of a detour," my driver proclaimed. "The Avenue of Broken Dreams." He turned down a street lined with one magnificent modern office building after another. Most of them were banks or financial institutions of some sort, he said. Now empty. At first I thought he was joking. It seemed impossible that all these stunning examples of contemporary architecture could be unoccupied. He slowed the car. I pressed my face against the glass and, peering up, saw that many of the windows still had little stickers pasted in their corners. It was uncanny. He slowed even more, and I could see that inside there was nothing. No desks or chairs, not even curtains. Just huge, empty caverns. "Another ghost town," he said. "Unbelievable." "Be thankful you're just visiting." He gave me a look. "I live here." "I'm afraid we all live here." This book is about that here, where we are now, how we got to this desperate place, and where to go next. Wall Street may not look like Reykjavik's Avenue of Broken Dreams yet, any more than that avenue resembled the tumbleweed-strewn streets of an abandoned tombstone. Nevertheless, during the past couple of years, we in the United States have seen the signs. We have been bombarded by images that are shocking and extreme, graphs of soaring unemployment rates and a plummeting Dow Jones, tent cities of homeless men and women outside Sacramento, California, and Portland, Oregon, auto company presidents flying to Washington, D.C. in private jets to beg Congress for massive bailouts, a disgraced AIG announcing that it would pay $450 million in bonuses to the executives that brought it down. Former NASDAQ chairman Bernard Madoff pleading guilty to bilking investors out of billions of dollars. The images go on and on. They depress us. They may have been a surprise to many, but the fact is we should have seen them coming. My professors in the late 1960s did. Many contemporary students did, too. We had plenty of warnings, Martha, a freshman at Stanford University, told me. A U.S. budget deficit of over $1 trillion, the mortgage bubble, massive loans doled out to people who couldn't afford them, an extremely expensive war, the outsourcing of jobs, abolishing the bank laws. How could we not know? Yet we still deceive ourselves. The occasional periods of good news, when the stock market appears to revive or gas prices drop, lull us into believing that the worst is over. We are Pavlov's dogs. The gong rings and our saliva flows. It is a dangerous illusion that distracts us from dealing with the deeper problems. The real story, I wrote in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, published in November 2004, is that we are living a lie. We have created a veneer that hides the fatal cancers beneath the surface. Unfortunately, a great many people have not wanted to look beyond the veneer. Our political and business leaders have encouraged us to stay the course. Too often we have fallen back on old platitudes. We have accepted the cancer, the predatory mutant virus of capitalism, as the norm. We have convinced ourselves that we can continue consuming a disproportionate share of the world's resources and charge it to credit cards without ever paying the usurious interest rates or the consequences. How do you muster the courage, I asked in Confessions, to step out of line and challenge concepts you and your neighbors have always accepted as gospel, even when you suspect that the system is ready to self-destruct? We have failed to muster that courage. We have allowed our government to chase the shadows of terrorists across Iraq, paw through our purses and briefcases in airports searching for explosive tubes of toothpaste, desecrate our most sacred documents by imprisoning people without the right to habeas corpus, and convince us that criticizing our president was treasonous. We have accepted the idea that countries whose GDPs were a fraction of AIG's losses were members of an evil axis, while we have trashed laws that had protected us from rapacious financiers. We have supported operations that scoured Colombian jungles for terrorists, but neglected to search the ledgers of companies with the power to destroy our economy. The election of President Obama was symbolic. Leaping from conservative Republican to liberal Democrat in one night signaled a profound change in U.S. voter attitudes. It sent the message that we want change. The Obama administration's plans to rein in the credit card industry, impose stricter auto emissions and mileage standards, create a financial regulatory commission, and implement other initiatives may shove us back on the path, if they ever pass Congress. However, the unfortunate and unspoken truth is that the path will not lead us to real change. It is not a way out of this morass. It will simply take us on a more circuitous route to disaster. We must blaze a new path. My daughter Jessica and my son-in-law Dan gave me a grandson on September 25th, 2007. A couple of months later, on Thanksgiving Day, I renewed a vow I had made some years earlier to devote the rest of my life to help create a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. My grandson, Grant, had inspired me with a new sense of urgency. I know what Grant does not, that his life is threatened by the crises generated during my watch. The question is not about prevention, nor is it about returning to normal, a world where the majority are exploited by a tiny minority. We are challenged today to transform ourselves and our economy. As an EHM, I participated in many of the events that propelled us into this dangerous territory we know as normal. As a writer and lecturer, I have spent the past 5 years touring the United States and other countries, speaking to political and business leaders, students, teachers, laborers, and all manner of people. I come away feeling hopeful that we are ready for the transformation that will be our salvation, that will save Grant's world. The first part of this book offers an overview of the root causes of our problems. Through understanding these, we can assess the options before us. Part 2 is devoted to exploring those options. It outlines a course of action that we can take, both as individuals and as a society, to implement a system that my grandson and all his siblings across the planet will want to inherit. Many books have been written about the pros and cons of President Obama's economic plan, current schemes for reforming Wall Street, and other short-term policies. These books deal with triage, that is, emergency quick fixes recommended to stop the hemorrhaging. This book goes beyond the triage. It identifies the virus that infected us and prescribes a long-term cure. Part 1. The Problem. Chapter 1. Not a Fluke. The Facts. When I was an economic hitman, EHM, I analyzed the statistics of many third world countries. I never saw any plummet as rapidly as those of my own country, the United States, during the past couple of years. We have all seen the facts in bits and pieces, but some of the more important ones are summarized below, along with my personal observation that things are actually worse than we are being told. If you feel that you are overloaded with facts, skip to the second part of this chapter, the challenge. The immediate crises began with the U.S. economy. One of the first signs occurred in the housing market, where prices peaked to historical highs in 2005 and then began to tumble in 2006. The ensuing declines in other economic sectors further exacerbated the housing crisis. As a result of the huge bets placed on the subprime mortgage market by Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, AIG, and the overall financial community, the system imploded. In 2008, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, and Bear Stearns was rescued at the last minute when J.P. Morgan Chase bought the company for $2 a share. AIG, Bank of America, and Citigroup would have collapsed as well if not for the extreme government intervention in the form of massive bailouts. In the end, major U.S. financial institutions and the markets they dominate lost roughly the equivalent of the total U.S. gross domestic product, about $14 trillion. A former U.S. senator and a current managing director of the merchant bank Allen & Company, Bill Bradley summed it up at a symposium on April 30, 2009. The national government has now made about $12.7 trillion in guarantees and commitments to the U.S. financial sector, and we've already spent a little over $4 trillion in this crisis. U.S. taxpayers are into Citicorp for about $400 billion. Paul Krugman, winner of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics, added, U.S. households have seen their net worth decline abruptly by $13 trillion, and there are similar blows occurring around the world. The global financial meltdown spread throughout the economy. By December 30, 2008, the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index plunged further than it ever had before. Residential construction dropped by 38%. In the first months of 2009, gross domestic product fell at an average annual rate of over 6%. Industrial production tumbled 13%. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics announced, in April 2009, job losses were large and widespread across nearly all major private sector industries. Overall, private sector employment fell by 611,000, and the number of unemployed people increased to 13.7 million, nearly 9% of the labor force. The recession officially entered its 16th month in May 2009, placing it on track to become the longest since the Great Depression. Every time a new statistic was published, it seemed to shatter previous records. The prognosis was increasingly depressing. Corporate inventories fell by $104 billion, the most since the compilation of such statistics began in 1947. Exports collapsed by 30%, the largest decline in four decades. Business investment plummeted nearly 40%, another record. Home building activity dove 38%. Companies cut total spending at the unheard-of annual rate of 38%. Another historic milestone was passed when 12% of Americans fell behind on their mortgage payments or went into foreclosure. General Motors, considered a bellwether of economic health, first announced that it would idle 13 U.S. assembly plants and trim production by 190,000 vehicles. Then, on June 1, 2009, it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, stating that the restructuring would result in the loss of 21,000 more jobs, the shuttering of at least 12 factories, and the closing of 2,600 car dealerships. Finally, it suffered the ultimate ignominy. It was essentially nationalized by the U.S. government. The recession infected the entire planet. The United Nations World Economic Situation and Prospects 2009 report projected a global economic decline of 2.6% for the year, a huge shift from its prior worst-case forecast for 2009 of 0.5%. The report issued in January stated, "The global credit crunch has continued straining the real economy worldwide." It forecast that unemployment would hit 50 million over the next 2 years, a figure that, it said, could easily double if the situation continues to deteriorate. The United Nations further predicted that world trade volumes would drop 11% in 2009, the largest annual decline since the Great Depression. Yet the forecasts, as dire as they were, painted an unrealistically optimistic picture. The statistics clearly indicated that we were being manipulated and blatantly deceived by our governments and the world's financial institutions. These people were playing the game I had been taught as an EHM. Make the future appear rosier than it could possibly be. do everything to keep people calm, maintain the status quo. In the statistics I read, the worst-case scenarios were grossly understated. For example, news out of China indicated that at least 26 million people were already unemployed there. If an additional 13.7 million were jobless in the United States, then world figures must already have surpassed the United Nations forecast of 50 million by a significant amount. Another confirmation of this strategy came at the end of the first quarter of 2009, when analysts strove to convince us that the economy was turning around. However, Federal Reserve forecasts issued in May predicted that the economy would drop by 2% in 2009, a major correction from the 1.3% decline previously estimated. The Fed revised its earlier unemployment projections of 8.8% to 9.6%. It is prudent to assume that these adjusted forecasts were also optimistic and that the actual numbers will be far worse. George Soros, chairman of Soros Fund Management, LLC, and the Open Society Institute, and author of The Crash of 2008 and What It Means, shared his advice to President Barack Obama during the April 3, 2008 symposium referenced above. He has to reconstruct the financial system because it cannot be restored to what it was. The challenge. The collapse we are suffering today is neither a fluke nor short-termed. It is the result of policies and attitudes that began before I became an EHM nearly four decades ago. Since World War II, we have been in the process of sculpting history's first truly global empire. Instead of gladiators in camouflage suits, we sent in artists with briefcases and computer models. They applied the laser-sharp tools of economics to chisel away at precious minerals mined from the Third World. Typically, our corporations identified a country that owned something they coveted. Resources considered vital or strategic chunks of real estate. Then the EHMs shuttled off to convince the leaders of that country that what they needed were massive loans from the World Bank and its sister organizations. However, the money, the leaders were informed, would not be dispensed directly to their country. It would instead pay U.S. corporations to build infrastructure projects such as power plants, harbors, and industrial parks. These will benefit you, the leaders were assured, and your friends, the few wealthy local families who owned businesses that thrive on electricity, exportation, and manufactured goods. We neglected to point out that the primary beneficiaries would be our own companies, the ones that constructed the projects. After a few years, the EHMs returned to the country. They said, rubbing their chins like artists studying a model. Looks like you're about to default on those massive loans you accepted. When the model began to quake with trepidation, they gave a little smile. Not to worry. We can fix everything. All you have to do is sell your oil, or some other resource, cheap to our corporations. Drop the environmental and labor laws that make it tough on us. Agree never to impose tariffs on U.S. goods. Accept the trade barriers we want to erect around your products. Privatize your utilities, schools, and other public institutions, and sell them to our companies. Send troops to support ours in places like Iraq. It is a system that evolved through the subterfuge and economic cunning of people who freely move back and forth between corporations and the U.S. government, collectively the corporatocracy. The leadership is epitomized by men like Robert McNamara, who served as president of Ford Motor Company, Secretary of Defense under Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, and finally as World Bank president. George Shultz, who was a professor of economics and dean of the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, Secretary of Labor, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Secretary of the Treasury under President Richard Nixon, Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan, President of the Bechtel Group, Advisor to President George W. Bush, and Chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase Bank's International Advisory Council, and Richard Dick Cheney, who was the White House Chief of Staff under President Gerald Ford, Minority Whip in the House of Representatives in 1989, Secretary of Defense under President George H.W. Bush, Chairman and CEO of Halliburton Company, and Vice President under President George W. Bush. Wandering around an art exhibit in Ecuador recently, I came upon a beautifully executed pen and ink drawing of an unmistakable Dick Cheney. He had one foot planted firmly on the White House and the other on Halliburton's new Dubai headquarters. He was waving a fistful of contracts in one hand and an AK-47 in the other, and was squatting over Africa and the Middle East, pants around his ankles, to answer the call of nature. Beneath him was the caption, "How the World Sees It." At the highest levels, there is no separation between the people who run our biggest businesses and those in charge of our government. The front lines, however, are manned by EHMs like me. And we always know that the real hitmen, the jackals, lurk in the shadows behind us, ready to overthrow or assassinate any leaders who refuse to accept our conditions. On the few occasions when covert efforts fail, as in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military swings into action. The model was so successful overseas that we imported it into the United States. Many of the same policies and techniques that we EHMs demanded of leaders in the Philippines, Zaire, Congo, and Ecuador were introduced into New York, California, and Michigan. Among the most prevalent here in the United States, the abandonment of laws that force corporations to adhere to strict environmental, social, truth in advertising, and other standards that once protected the rights of the general populace. Assumption of large amounts of personal, corporate, and governmental debt. Privatization of utilities, prisons, and other public institutions. Increased police surveillance under the guise of homeland security, and the use of public lands to serve corporate interests. I say successful, but that is true only if you happen to be a member of the corporatocracy, that club of CEO power brokers of business and finance who dine with the likes of senators, members of Congress, regulators, and presidents. For everybody else, it has been an abject failure. We the people have seen our privileges constantly eroded, from Medicare to public schools, watched the mom-and-pop stores owned by our neighbors fall victim to huge chains, witnessed the usurpation of the media by a handful of giant conglomerates, and now we find ourselves suffering under an economic recession we were told could never again occur. Although I had been an EHM for nearly 7 years, I did not understand the profound implications of the system I was perpetuating until 1978. My job at the time was to convince Panama's chief of government, Omar Torrijos, to assume a huge World Bank loan. Bankrupting his country would assure U.S. control over the canal, despite the recent treaties returning it to Panama, and guarantee that our corporations would be awarded lucrative construction contracts. It was a classic EHM scam to corrupt a leader, make him rich, and place his country in a position where we could exploit it mercilessly. But Omar was not buying. "I don't need your damn money, Juanito," he said one afternoon. He and I were standing on the deck of a luxurious sailing yacht that was docked at Contadora Island, a safe haven where U.S. politicians and corporate executives enjoyed sex and drugs away from the prying eyes of the international press and their wives. Omar leaned against the polished mahogany railing and gave me his most charming smile. "I got a fine house, plenty of good food, fast cars, a friend who lends me his yacht." He straightened and spread his arms to embrace the cockpit where several of his closest male advisors shared rum cocktails with half a dozen bikini-clad young women. "Just about everything a man could want." Then he frowned. "Except one thing." He went on to tell me that his goal was to set his people free from Yankee shackles, to make sure his country controlled the canal, and to help Latin America liberate itself from the very thing I represented, and that he referred to as predatory capitalism. "You know," he added, What I'm suggesting will ultimately benefit your children, too. He explained that the system I was promoting, where a few exploited the many, was doomed. The same as the old Spanish Empire, it will implode. He took a drag off his Cuban cigar and exhaled the smoke slowly, like a man blowing a kiss. Unless you and I and all our friends fight the predatory capitalists, he warned, the global economy will go into shock. He glanced across the water at the sandy beach and palm trees of Contadora, and then back to me. No permitas que te engañen, he said. Don't allow yourself to be hoodwinked. I am convinced that Omar's attempts to change the system cost him his life. He died when his private plane crashed in June 1981, an incident that much of the international press labeled as a CIA assassination. Although I was stunned when I learned the tragic news, I was not surprised. I had feared for many months that if he did not succumb to EHM efforts to corrupt him, the jackals would get him, just as they had Mohammed Mossadegh of Iran, Yaqub Arbenz of Guatemala, Ahmed Sukarno of Indonesia, Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, Salvador Allende of Chile, Jaime Roldos of Ecuador, and so many others before him. No one in the United States wanted to shoulder Omar's cause, least of all our presidents. Like the U.S. Congress, they tucked their tails between their legs and sidled up to their masters, the corporate heads who financed campaigns and demanded more influence and power. We the people, the voters and consumers, clamored for cheaper goods, oblivious for the most part to the toll exacted on rainforests, mountaintops, coral reefs, and human workers. Briefly, in the late 1960s, it appeared that we might shake off our lethargy when a national news anchor, Walter Cronkite, came back from Vietnam to announce that the war was not going as smoothly as our government claimed. His words inspired people to take to the streets, demanding an end to the fighting, and eventually the war became so unpopular that President Nixon was forced to find an exit. But once Saigon fell, we returned to our slumber, failing to explore the underlying causes of the conflict. We ignored the fact that the war transformed millionaires into billionaires and was merely the symptom of a more insidious illness that would come back to haunt us. We watched Cronkite retire, and we stood idly by as his network and all the others were bought up by their corporatocracy, and news reporting was replaced by sensationalized entertainment. We neglected to protest when Clinton's African Renaissance supported one brutal dictator after another, as long as the country opened its doors to U.S. corporate plunder and profits. With few exceptions, we did not challenge the logic of sending our military into Iraq after 9/11. We ignored the trade agreements our government struck that were grossly unfair to other countries, the enormous amounts of debt that were mounting around the globe, and the outrageous powers Washington granted to big business by deregulating industry after industry. We celebrated the cult of the CEO, giving the people who manage our corporations unprecedented riches, until the pay of the average CEO grew to more than 400 times the salary of the average worker, far surpassing the ratios at any previous time in history, or those in Europe, Japan, and elsewhere. We plastered the covers of the business magazines with the Wall Street warriors who made billions of dollars, in part by skimming profits and creating new and riskier financial tools. It was the old formula of the few benefiting at the expense of the many. We failed to recognize the pathetic fact that in this case, the many were us. The recession hit hard, and still we did nothing, except bail out the banks, insurance companies, automobile manufacturers, and the executives who had bulldozed our savings. We did not bother to peer beyond our wallets into the eyes of people who were shooting each other over Nike tennis shoes in our own ghettos, or at the ones with skeletal bodies who were starving around the world. We failed to smell the fumes that were suffocating the Chinese cities where our beloved gadgets were manufactured. The human rights group, Amnesty International, warned in May 2009 that the worldwide economic decline was leading to greater repression across the globe, concluding that we are sitting on a powder keg of inequality, injustice, and insecurity, and it is about to explode. The Global Humanitarian Forum reported that global warming causes more than 300,000 deaths each year. We ignored all these signs and countless others. We watched funding dry up for environmental protection programs, for those non-profit and non-governmental organizations, NGOs, dedicated to improving social and living conditions for the poor, the young, the old, and the vulnerable, and for projects dedicated to monitoring and safeguarding the conditions on our planet that make life as we know it possible. We eschewed the changes that would benefit our children and their children. Instead, we complained about rising gasoline prices and taxes, we bought Hummers and iPods, and we supported policies that funded political campaigns and lined the pockets of CEOs. We deceived ourselves into believing in the efficacy of a system where less than 5% of the world's population lives in the United States, but consumes more than 25% of the world's resources, while nearly half the world's population struggles to survive at or below the poverty level. Where nearly 200 million children serve as child laborers, de facto slaves, working under inhumane conditions. Where poor countries pay $1.30 servicing foreign debt for every dollar they receive in foreign aid. And where one continent, Africa, expends four times more on debt payments than on health care. We read statistics like these, glanced around at each other, shrugged, and tried to convince ourselves that our system may not be perfect, but it's the best there is. We who live in a society that can fly people to the moon, immunize against smallpox, clone sheep, and transmit entire books instantly through the internet, continually neglected to ask the questions that would connect the dots. If 5% of the world's population consumes 25% of the resources, the transference of this same economic model to China, India, Africa, and Latin America would require what? If our system is dependent on turning countless millions of children into financial slaves, what does the future hold for our children? If the industrialized world can feed its appetite for cheap petroleum only by keeping other countries under its thumb and subjecting them to debts they can never repay, our future prosperity and lifestyles will inevitably do what in the future? We avoided answering these questions because they led to one inevitable conclusion. Our present system is a failure. We have not wanted to hear that to provide the other 95% of the world's population with the same resources we use would require at least another five planets just like ours, except without people. That continuing to abuse the children of other nations will create a world for our children that is torn by ever-increasing violence. That burdening others with debts too huge to be repaid will ultimately destroy our economy as well as theirs. We have not wanted to hear that returning to normal is simply not an option. Chapter 2. Titans Clash, Keynes versus Friedman. My work as an EHM promoting major infrastructure projects in third world countries was based on a messianic belief in privatization and profits. This gospel generated the crises that currently confront us, the economic collapse, and a host of other ills, global warming, human rights abuses, the growing gap between the haves and have-nots of the world, diminishing resources, and rising prices for oil, food, and other commodities. What few realize is that the underlying policies are the direct result of a clash of titans. It is a struggle that changed history. John Maynard Keynes, a British economist who wrote the classic text, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, first published in 1936, fought valiantly for the rights of the common man as a key to successful capitalism. and his ideas gained popularity among academics and policymakers before and following World War II. He overturned many prevailing theories about the validity of free markets, including the idea that unrestricted markets can, assuming that workers agree to reduce their wages, provide full employment. This was a particularly important concept because free markets had been used by industrialists to justify union busting and the squalid working conditions that existed in many factories. Keynes argued that large-scale government spending, supported through taxation, instead of sacrifices on labor's part, was the remedy to the mass unemployment that accompanies depressions. In the 1950s, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower initiated public investment programs such as a national superhighway network founded on Keynesian principles. In a successful attempt to avoid being labeled as a progressive or a Roosevelt New Dealer by his own party, Ike promoted these programs as a necessary defense against the rising red menace of the Soviet Union. In 1961, John F. Kennedy, the newly elected Democratic president, was guided by a conviction that money from Washington stimulated economic growth. He invested in programs that inspired individuals to expand their horizons and encouraged businesses to innovate. His New Frontier promised federal funding for education, medical care for the elderly, government action to combat the recession, and an end to racial discrimination. His Peace Corps, which I joined in 1968, inspired Americans to reach out to people in other countries. His space program and the commitment to land human beings on the moon was aimed at funneling public funds into areas that would both benefit and regulate the private sector. After JFK's assassination in 1963, President Lyndon Johnson took Keynes' ideas to new levels. His Great Society launched major spending programs for medical care, education, urban revitalization, and transportation. Many senior Republicans bought into Keynesian economics as well. When Richard Nixon was elected president in 1968, he increased direct payments from the federal government to individual citizens through Social Security, Medicare, food aid, and public assistance. Such payments rose from about 6% of the GNP to nearly 9% during his administration. He also imposed wage and price controls on big corporations, and he went so far as to state, "We are all Keynesians." Yet strong forces of resistance arrayed themselves against Keynes. His ideas were vilified by conservative business people and politicians who resented the limitations and regulations imposed on them by such policies. They complained that unions had grown too powerful and that expensive labor and too many regulations had given other countries unfair advantages. "Outrageous," Jake Dauber exclaimed between mouthfuls of Indonesian satay during a trip to Asia in the early 1970s. Dauber was president of Chaz Team Maine, Inc., Maine, the Boston-based consulting company where I worked. He had invited me and several other Maine executives to join him in the plush restaurant on the top floor of Jakarta's Intercontinental Hotel. "Simply outrageous that the Japanese can undermine every U.S. manufacturing business. They steal our ideas and then produce the goods we invented for half the price, all because of our damn unions." Jake and other chief executives like him searched for political champions. Eventually, they were rewarded by an unlikely alliance between a former movie actor turned politician and an economist from the University of Chicago, where George Shultz was dean of the Graduate School of Business, who was soon to become a superstar. Ronald Reagan and the professor whose image had appeared to me in Iceland, Milton Friedman, formed a team that pugnaciously defied Keynes. Friedman's ideas would ultimately be celebrated with a Nobel Prize. The diminutive academic with the dragonfly eyeglasses at first seemed an unlikely warrior. He had been raised in the enemy camp as a Keynesian economist. Then, like the trolls escaping the Icelandic sun, he scuttled to the other side. He turned against his former mentor, by proposing a radically different policy that he called monetarism. Friedman theorized that the government could not manage the economy because people would shift their behavior to thwart it. He believed that CEOs of private companies would serve the public interest better than civil servants. Keynesian principles, he argued, led to stagflation, high inflation, and low economic growth, the very economic conditions that hamstrung the U.S. economy throughout most of the 1970s. His solution? Further reduce taxes and annul the very regulations that were implemented during the New Deal to bring America out of the Great Depression. Keynesians contended that Friedman ignored the many imperfections in free markets. Chief among these was their contention that people do not always behave ethically. Executives may abuse information that is not available to others, such as profiting from information about the introduction of new products and the subsequent changes in stock prices. Financial experts intentionally confuse the public with the smoke and mirrors of obscure language such as collateralized debt and derivatives. Traders who have access to data about goods that are essentially the same but are sold at different prices in different markets, Botswana and Bolivia, for example, use this knowledge to profit from the spreads. Keynesians maintain that without regulations, the market is a petri culture for corruption. Friedman, however, won the war of the economic titans when Ronald Reagan rode off the silver screen and into the California governor's mansion and then all the way to the White House. Here was a politician who simply loved the mantras, "The social responsibility of business is to increase profits," and "less government is good government." Reagan's political victories were the beginning of an era that would be distinguished by the transference of assets from public to private ownership and the dissolution of laws that had protected consumers and investors from unscrupulous business operators. In retrospect, it was an era characterized by greed, an obsession with materialism, excessive debt, corporate government and individual, the formation of huge conglomerates, and ultimately the type of corruption symbolized by Enron, Bernard Madoff, and the debacle on Wall Street. In the nearly three decades following Reagan's election, the multinational corporations prospered, while public investments in roads and bridges, water and sewer systems, and hospitals and schools came to a virtual halt. Increasingly, cities, counties, and states were forced to sell sectors of what had once been considered public property to private corporations. It is estimated that today more than $2 trillion is needed to repair infrastructure that was built during and after the New Deal and then neglected as a result of Friedman economics. The idea that a free marketplace would ultimately stimulate the economies of the developing as well as the developed countries continued to guide many of Washington's policies for years. As President, Bill Clinton, influenced by two Friedman disciples, former Treasury Secretary and former Goldman Sachs CEO Robert Rubin, and Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, championed free trade agreements like the World Trade Organization's WTO agreements, which include the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, and the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, that benefited multinational corporations that were major political campaign donors. George W. Bush, elected president in 2000, called upon Friedman to justify his famous "go shopping" advice to the American public after 9/11, his trade deals in Latin America, and even his enormous investments in the Iraq War. He was a staunch disciple of the Chicago professor, as was his father before him, Britain's Margaret Thatcher, Canada's Brian Mulroney, Iceland's Tavith Oddsson, and Chile's Augusto Pinochet. Ironically, those who railed hardest against government investments in programs that benefit the middle and lower classes incurred huge budget deficits of their own in order to support the military and the corporations that serve it. In the 1980s, President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, Star Wars, channeled billions of dollars to military contractors. George W. Bush's post-9/11 campaigns against terrorism here and abroad racked up the largest deficit in U.S. history. He also created countless new billionaires, substantially increased the wealth of the richest Americans while reducing the real income and wages of the rest of the country, and drove the U.S. economy to its knees. Michael Parenti, political analyst and author of many books, including Democracy for the Few and Super Patriotism, summarized the evolution of the national debt during those years in this way. When Ronald Reagan came into office, the national debt was $800 billion. When he left office, it was $2.5 trillion. He also put in the biggest tax program that ever was, but it was a regressive tax. It was a Social Security tax on tens of millions of people. When George Bush Sr. came in, the national debt went from $2.5 to $5 trillion. Clinton, I'll give him credit for one thing, he did try to go for solvency. But when you got to George Bush Jr. for 8 years, the debt has gone from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. When George W. Bush was elected president, the 400 wealthiest people in the United States were worth about $1 trillion. 6 years later, in 2007, their worth had grown by 60% to $1.6 trillion. At the same time, the real income of the average worker decreased by more than $2,000. The consequences of Friedman's free market philosophy came to a head in the last years of the Bush administration, as the financial markets around the globe collapsed, lending to businesses halted, companies laid off workers, and the economy tumbled into freefall. Yet even in the face of such appalling losses, the favored few of the corporatocracy continued to reap huge salaries and bonuses, as if it were their due. These policies resulted in the headlines that buffeted us for the next year, sickening everyone in 2008 and 2009. AIG to pay out $450 million in bonuses. Countrywide execs form new firm to profit off mortgages, bank failures. Merrill Lynch paid $10 million bonuses to top execs. Lawmakers question bankers on bailout. Texas firm accused of $8 billion fraud. Contrite over misstep, auto chiefs take to road. 100 ex-government staffers working as bank lobbyists on bailouts. Goldman Sachs reports $1.6 billion first quarter profit. ExxonMobil CEO receives 10% raise. Survey, more pay raises than cuts for U.S. CEOs. Why are bankers still being treated as Beltway royalty? AIG bonuses higher than previously disclosed. These are the type of headlines and articles one might expect to read in the history books that describe events leading up to the 1929 crash and Great Depression, rather than the front pages of 21st century newspapers and websites. Such headlines are the opposite of humorous. Yet when I read them, I am reminded of a story about Keynes and Friedman standing before St. Peter at the gates of heaven. When asked to account for themselves, Keynes claimed that he had tried to save millions of poor people from starving during the Depression. Friedman stated bluntly that his life had been devoted to ridding humanity of sin. "How so?" St. Peter asked Friedman. "Breaking rules is a sin," the bespectacled professor replied. "I tried to do away with the rules." There will never be another Great Depression. It was a refrain heard often while I was a business school student in the late 1960s. My professors were confident that the laws enacted to avoid such catastrophes would protect us. And they were right. The United States experienced four recessions during the past three decades. One that began in 1980 and lasted nearly 2 years. One in 1990 that lasted less than a year and was followed by the longest economic expansion on record. One that began in March 2001 and ended in November, and the current one that can be traced to events in 2006 and really got underway in the summer of 2007. We bounced back from the first three recessions because we were protected by many of the regulations that I had learned about as a business student. Unfortunately, over the past two decades, those laws had been constantly eroded, dropped, or negated. Then, as a nation, we reached a stage where our corporations behaved like spoiled and rebellious adolescents. Young people grow up believing that they have to do better than their contemporaries in their studies, sports, art, dance, or with the opposite sex. Excelling for the sake of simply being good at a task takes a back seat to beating out the other guy. One of the stages before adulthood is characterized by a refusal to follow the rules, often with the excuse that those things just hamper my ability to compete, to be myself, to really excel. Capitalism has gone through a similar process. In order for one clothing manufacturer or car company to succeed, it believes it has to lure customers away from its competitors. On a grander scale, this same drive leads to market domination and exploitation. For centuries, human beings have clung to a belief that in order to get ahead, communities, including countries, have to exploit their neighbors. This is the foundation for the old military empires, from ancient China and Greece to the British Empire, to today's post-World War II neocolonialism. The insatiable quest to beat out any possible competitors, real or imagined, has been rapidly draining our planet of its most precious resources. While unrelenting competition is a sign of immature adolescence, cooperation indicates a more seasoned maturity. We associate organizational skills that result in cooperation as symbols of advanced social orders. We are impressed by and avidly study those animals that form cooperative groupings like wolves, lions, dolphins, and chimpanzees. As human communities, too, grow more sophisticated, we see advantages in collaboration and therefore form alliances. Thus, city-states became nations, and nations draw up pacts with other nations to support and protect each other, like NATO and the European Union. One has to wonder why, after World War II and the establishment of the United Nations, the World Bank, and other institutions that were intended to foster global cooperation, the U.S. government and corporate chiefs have continued to promote a model that emphasizes competition and exploitation. Why have the pacts signed by post-1980 Washington, such as free trade agreements, turned out to have been attempts not to unify, but rather to divide and conquer the rest of the economic world? The answer is that in the war of economic titans, Friedman defeated Keynes. The victors implemented a radical system that promoted a world in which millions of people face starvation and environmental degradation and the depletion of natural resources threatens the very survival of life forms as we know them. Politically, Ronald Reagan's presidential election in 1980 is the threshold year. But the origins of this reckless drive towards self-destruction began nearly 30 years earlier, when Keynesian economics reigned and Friedman was still developing his theories. The first salvo was like that single shot on the Concord Bridge that opened the American Revolution. It changed the world. Except this time it was a covert event that occurred on the other side of the planet. It helped convince a young Ronald Reagan to switch from Democrat to Republican, from Keynes to Friedman, from his role as president of the Screen Actors Guild to that of Union Buster. I first heard about that event from Claudine Martin, the stunningly attractive, seductive, and manipulative woman who mentored me during my first months as an EHM.